Sounds True presents The Wisdom of Your Cells, How Your Beliefs Control Your Biology, with Dr. Bruce Lipton, the author of The Biology of Belief, and an internationally recognized authority in bridging science and spirit. And now, Session 1, The Wisdom of Your Cells, The New Biology, with Dr. Bruce Lipton.
I so appreciate that you have taken the opportunity to listen to this presentation titled The Wisdom of Your Cells. For in this science that we're going to hear is a new biology, a biology that will profoundly change civilization and the world that we live in. This new biology takes us from the belief that we are victims of our genes, that we are a biochemical machine, that life is out of our control, into another reality, a reality where our thoughts, our beliefs, our mind totally control our genes, our behavior, and the life that we experience. The interesting part about this biology is that it's really based on current modern science, but with some new perceptions added in that are relatively recent. And the significance of all this is that since we didn't apparently pick our genes, and since we can't change our genes, and since the belief is that genes control who we are, then we have to look at ourselves as recipients of programs, and that we must then try to live out our life given the programs that we received at conception. However, there's a new understanding coming, and this new understanding is at the leading edge of science, and I'm trying to bring this down to the population, for the reason is this, is that this new science takes us from victims to creators. And the relevance about that is that we are actually very, very powerful in creating and unfolding the lives that we lead. So that what I would like to provide you with is a scientific foundation to give you an understanding of who we really are. This is actually knowledge of self. And if we go back and understand the old axiom, knowledge is power, then what we're really beginning to understand is knowledge of self is knowledge of self-power. And this is what I think that we will be able to get from understanding the new biology. My first introduction into biology was in second grade. At that time, I remember I went to school early in the fall that year, and when we were all getting ready to settle down in the classroom, Mr. Bangelsdorf brought in a microscope, and he was going to show us the cells. And I remember how exciting it was that we were all lined up as he focused the image of the microscope on some amoebas and paramecia in this little field of swamp water. And all the kids were getting up there, getting a chance to look at it. And finally, I got my chance to look down the barrel of the microscope, and there I saw the first time these little cells moving around in their own environment. And in that seven-year-old mind of mine, I looked at these and realized that these cells were not just bumping around and looking like little pinball machines where they were just bouncing off the walls, that these cells looked very busy. They were industrious. They were looking around at things. They were checking things over here, and then the cell would move and check things over there. Immediately at that stage, I began to realize that these were actually sentient beings. So even in that young mind, I started to make a connection to realize that there's these life forms down there, and that in consideration of my own particular life and the background I was coming from and the troubles of function and dysfunction as most of us experience in our family growth, when I saw this other world, it offered me another place to go and see life from, like, looking over a cell's shoulder. Well, it was interesting because I didn't realize that great introduction that I had back in second grade was actually going to shape the rest of my life. About 12 years later, I ended up in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, where I graduated from conventional microscopes into electron microscopy and then had a further opportunity to look into the lives of these cells. And the relevance about that is the lessons that I learned from these cells profoundly changed my life and gave me insights about the world that we live in that I would like to share with you. So this is more or less a story from our cells. In the opportunity of using electron microscopy to look at cells, not only did I see the cells from the outside, but I was able to fly through their interior and go through the cell's anatomy and understand the nature of its organization, its structures, and its functions. And this was just a wonderful opportunity to go visit this other world. I used to actually laugh that they were actually paying me for this job, where I get to go sit in this room with, it actually looked like Star Trek, with this giant electron microscope, a column of steel and pumping machines and LEDs and lights flashing, and then get a chance to fly into cells. So as much as people talk about flying into outer space, I was going into inner space and seeing vistas that no people have ever seen before. So it was this great opportunity. And that through this understanding, I started to get a greater appreciation of the nature of life and the nature of cells and our involvement with our own cells. It was at this time that I also started to do some training in cell culturing. And in fact, in about 1968, I started cloning stem cells. Well, today, stem cells are a hot topic, and everyone thinks, well, wow, where did they come from? Stem cells, just a couple of years ago, nobody talked about them. Essentially, I had been working on stem cells for about 40 years. During that time, I was really given the opportunity to create my own culture systems and then observe and track the fate of cells and then try to look at their structure and their biochemistry as they change their life, as they change their fate, to get an idea of the mechanisms that were controlling cell biology. So in 1968, I was doing my first cloning experiment, and it was under the guidance of Dr. Irv Koenigsberg. Now, Irv was a brilliant scientist, and he was the man who actually created the first stem cell cultures. Well, during this process, on the very first day of setting up cultures, I was given some advice by Irv that I didn't realize until 20 years later how important this information was to the understanding of life on this planet. Essentially, I just completed the cell culture process, inoculated the cells into a petri dish, and was about to put the petri dish into the incubator, and Irv stopped me and he said a very important guidance about the work we were doing. And he said this. He said, when you come back in tomorrow, Bruce, and you look at these cells, if the cells don't look right, if they look unhealthy, before you really try to alter the cells, the first thing you have to look at are the conditions of the culture environment. So basically what Irv was really leading me on to was an understanding about the influence of the environment and the expression of health or disease among biological organisms. Throughout the rest of my research, I started working with these cells, these stem cells, and specifically the stem cells I was working with were called myoblasts. Myo means muscle, blast means progenitor. So these are stem cells that are not differentiated, they don't express any particular fate, but you can identify them because of their very unique spindle shape. What I was doing in my cultures was isolating these spindle-shaped cells and then allowing them to replicate and form a large colony so that all the cells in the colony were genetically identical, derived from the same precursor cell. So I was working with a uniform, genetically identical population of cells. Through my research, I started to realize that when I put my cells in the culture dishes with the conditions that support muscle growth, of course, the muscle cells evolve from these undifferentiated cells, and I would actually end up with cultures with giant contractile muscles derived from these single cell precursors. However, during the course of my experiments, I started to realize that if I started to change the environmental situations and the components of the culture medium, that the fate of the cells would be altered. So that I would start off with my same myoblasts, my muscle precursors, but in an altered environment, let's say environment B, when I put the cells into those petri dishes, they'd actually start to form bone cells. If I further altered and manipulated the culture conditions, and let's say create another condition called environment C, and put the same muscle precursors in that particular dish, those cells started to become adipose or fat cells. The results of these experiments were very exciting because what it really revealed was, while every one of the cells was genetically identical, the fate of the cells was not controlled by the cells, but was controlled by the environment in which I placed the cells. And why this was really relevant is because at the time I started doing these experiments, I also started teaching students, undergraduate students, and later teaching medical students at the University of Wisconsin, the conventional understanding that the fate of cells was controlled by genes. And yet in these experiments, it was clearly revealed that the fate of cells was more or less controlled by the environment that I was putting them in. So what I started to go into was this other view of what was controlling life. Well, my colleagues, of course, were very upset with my work because everyone was then on the bandwagon for the Human Genome Project that was getting tooled up, and everyone was really so far in support of the genes control life story, that when my story revealed how the environment would alter the cells, when they heard that story, it sort of made them a little uneasy, and then they talked about it as an exception to the rule, which to me was a little bit of a put-down, because I was thinking, well, there are no exceptions to the rule. There's some reason as to how the environment is controlling these particular cells. So I ran into a conflict because I realized that I was teaching medical students the conventional story of DNA and genes controlling life, and yet the cells in my laboratory were revealing a completely different understanding of life, where all the cells had the same genes, but their fate was really determined by the environment. Now I have a completely new understanding of life, because as I started to follow this research, it led to a new way about teaching people about cells. So let me start with this first understanding that I was contributing to my medical students about the nature of cells and cell biology. Number one, when we look at ourselves as a single individual human, so when I look in the mirror, I see Bruce. When you look in the mirror, you see yourself. You see yourself as a single person. Well, it's an interesting observation, but it's a misperception, meaning this. If you really understand the nature of who you are, you realize that you are actually a community of about 50 trillion living cells. Each cell is a living individual sentient being. Every cell has its own life. Every cell has its own functions. Every cell interacts with other cells in the nature of a community. So while we stand and look at ourselves in the mirror as a singular entity, if I would reduce you to the size of a cell and dropped you inside your own body, you wouldn't recognize yourself as a single entity. You'd see a very, very busy metropolis of trillions of individuals living in harmony, especially if we're in health, under one skin. So number one, we are not really a single entity. We are collective consciousness of upwards to 50 trillion individual amoeba-like cells, so that we actually represent a community. This becomes really relevant when we understand that health is when there's harmony in the community, and dis-ease is when there's a disharmony that tends to fracture the community relationships among ourselves. So number one, we are a community. Fact number two, while we look at the human and think about the human as being this magnificent biological organism with all the functions that we have built into our body, here's an interesting fact. There's not one new function in the human body that's not already present in every single cell. So, for example, while you have a digestive, respiratory, excretory system, a musculoskeletal system, an endocrine system, a reproductive system, of course, a nervous system, and even immune system, every one of those functions exists in every one of your cells. So every cell has all of the functions that a human can express. Interesting point, of course, is as humans made out of cells, just the logic says, how can we create something that our cells can't manufacture or our cells can't do? We are the reflection of our cells. So when we start to look at biology, we can look at a human and look at all of its functions, or at a more simple level, we could go down and look at a cell and look at the same functions present in a cell. And what's very interesting about this is that the pattern and structure and behavior of a cell is replicated in the human. In fact, we are made in the image of a cell. And this is very helpful for biologists, because we can do research on cells and then apply that information to understanding the nature of the human. Well, this is going to be a very important point through the rest of the discourse on this story on the biology of belief, for this reason is that while we'll be talking about cells, we must remember that we can interchange a human or a cell in regard to the basic behaviors and needs between the two. They're exactly the same. So in conclusion, in this regard, when I started teaching the students about cell biology, I got them to understand, A, that they were communities, and B, that the cells that make them up can do all of the functions and express all of the behaviors that a human has, and therefore we can really talk about them as being one and the same in this understanding. So it's really wonderful then to get into the nature of talking about cells, because what we're going to see is the character and behaviors of our life are reflected in these very simple structures. So I'm teaching in the medical school, and I'm teaching the fundamental nature of what is called the medical model. And the medical model is the perception that the human biology represents a biological machine comprised of biochemicals and controlled by genes. so that when a patient comes in to see a doctor and there's something wrong, the tendency in the belief system of the student educated with this belief is that the patient has something wrong with their biochemistry or genes, which can be adjusted and can lead them to health. When I started to confront my colleagues and say, well, I'm teaching this genetic story, I'm still having trouble explaining how the environment is controlling my genes, they had a tendency to disregard this information because it didn't fit the medical model. So at some point, I started to realize that I had to leave the university because I found great conflict in teaching the students what were apparently facts about what controls a cell and yet getting completely different understandings of control from the cells in my culture. During that opportunity, when I was outside of the university, I had a chance to read into physics, which we're going to talk about later on as well. And the reason why this is important is because this is again where I found the information that I started to read in the physics did not conform to the science that I was teaching in medical school. What is physics related to medicine? Well, simply this. Physics, by its definition, is the science of the mechanisms of the universe. In fact, physics and mechanics are synonyms with each other. That's why you can say quantum physics or quantum mechanics, and they represent exactly the same thing, or Newtonian physics and Newtonian mechanics. Well, the relevance was that as I started to look into the world of new physics, the world of quantum physics, I started to realize that the mechanisms that are described in the nature of that physical view of the universe completely collided with the mechanisms that we were teaching in medical school, which were based on Newtonian physics. So we're going to talk about the nature of the control mechanism. We're going to talk about the fact that it's not the genes, but we're also going to bring in the concept of a new physics, which was not introduced in medical school and currently is still not introduced in medical school, and that is the relationship of quantum physics to the operation and function of cells. And this becomes an important turning point for us because we're going to leave behind some very old beliefs that we bought as fundamental truths and enter into a new understanding of biology by adjusting the biology in regard to the new understanding of control and the new understanding of physics. The question is, how come it's so hard to get people to perceive new insights into the science of human biology, the medical model? And the answer is because we bought a belief and we've invested so much of our time and so much of our history into this belief that when changes start to become needed in the understanding, it's very difficult to introduce them because of the established point of view that has been concretized in our knowledge. And the issue is, so how come our belief in the medical model is so strong? Well, the answer is we must first go back to the origin of modern science. So we start to go back into the late 1500s and 1600s to see what kind of foundational beliefs were introduced when science began to introduce the world to a new way of seeing how life and the universe was working. Before conventional science, of course, there was a science, but it was a science delivered by the church. It was a science called natural theology, in which science was infused with the spiritual domain and that God's hand was directly involved in the unfoldment and maintenance of the world that we live in. So natural theology was really a belief that God's image was expressed through the nature that we lived in. And actually, the early form of science at that time, natural theology, had a mission statement, which is really to understand the nature of the environment so that we could learn to live in harmony with that. So it was basically learning how to live in harmony with God, considering that nature and God were so well connected. However, through the abuses of the church and their insistence on absolute knowledge and the efforts of suppressing new knowledge, there came a point where we experienced what's called the Reformation. And the Reformation, which was really precipitated by Martin Luther, was a challenge to the church's authority. And when that challenge was successful, it opened the doorway for science, because before then, when science would start to study the realm of nature and start to find information that didn't agree with what was being taught in the religious schools, these scientists were actually forced to recant their beliefs or undergo the so-called kangaroo trials of the Inquisition, which forced them to relent and go back and accept the information that was being taught by the church and let go of their views of visions that they acquired through their own scientific efforts. Again, this was to keep the nature of absolute knowledge in the hands of the church. But as I said, after the Reformation, when there was an opportunity to question the beliefs about the universe, this is when science was grounded and actually became what was called modern science. The foundational research that shapes modern science was provided by Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton is the physicist whose primary studies were involved understanding the nature of gravity and the movement of the planets in the solar system and the moon around the Earth, etc. And to understand the nature of how these movements occurred, Isaac Newton created a new mathematics called differential calculus and then tried to put data in about the objects in the solar system to create an equation where he could predict the movements of the solar system. The reason why the prediction is necessary is because modern science said, unlike the past where religious beliefs were just based on religious beliefs, science wanted to know if there were truths that could be understood. And so science introduced the concept of an ability to analyze the environment and understand the mechanisms that provide for the environment. But in that scientific analysis, it involved recording of data, the setting up of experiments based on hypotheses, and then recording that data from the experiments to see if the hypotheses and the actual observations fit. The conclusion is simply this. Science identified truths as things that were predictable. So what was Isaac Newton doing? He was creating equations where he could predict the movement of the planets in the solar system. And by doing so, if he could predict it, then his science would reveal a truth about the nature of the universe. In his equation, Isaac Newton included important things such as the mass of a planet, the acceleration of a planet, the vector in which direction that planet was trying to move, and he put these elements into his equations and was successful enough that he was able to actually predict the movement of the planets in our solar system. What was really, really relevant about Newton's work was this. In his equation, he only put material characteristics of the universe, the physical mass of, let's say, a planet, the acceleration of this mass, gravity, which was a factor of the mass. The more mass something has, the more gravity it has, and basically created these equations. But here was the exciting part. In his equations, Newton didn't put God, he didn't put spirit, he didn't put invisible forces. He just put material characteristics. And what was then relevant with the results of his study is he said you can understand the nature of the universe by only studying the material components, that it's not necessary to invoke God or spirit or invisible forces in how the universe works. This is the foundational understanding that seeded what is called Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics' characteristic is it perceives as the universe as a machine made out of matter and says if you can understand the nature of the matter that comprises that machine, then you will understand the nature of nature itself. So all of a sudden, the science that was evolving called modern science left behind the concept of invisible forces and spirit, and said, let's just focus on matter, that everything in the universe could be understood by looking at its material composition, and by studying that, you will understand the nature of life. So the new field of science took a whole different tack than where we were coming from, where we looked at our fate being controlled by spirits and forces beyond us. The new science says that we're controlled by the material character of which we're made. This also introduced a new mission statement of science. Since it is now perceived that the universe was a machine made out of matter, it also suggested that if we understood the nature of the machine, we can control and dominate the machine. So the mission of science was actually to control and dominate nature, which is completely different than the former mission of science under natural theology. That mission of science was to learn to live in harmony with nature. Now with modern science, we were out to control nature. Well, the issue of control in regard to biology becomes a very important point, and that is, well, what is it that controls us? What is it that controls the traits that we express? Well, there wasn't really any idea where to go with that until Charles Darwin created his theory of evolution on the origin of species by means of natural selection. In Charles Darwin's work, he offered a piece of information that most everybody at the time was quite familiar with, and that was this. The traits of an individual are connected to the traits of the parents. Back in those days, there was a lot of animal husbandry and plant breeding, and people were just breeding all kinds of animals as pets and as farm animals, and it was very clearly established that the traits of the parents would be expressed to some degree in the offspring. Well, if we go back into understanding what Newton said that the universe is made out of matter. To understand the universe, you can just look at the matter and don't have to invoke invisible forces. Since life forms are parts of the universe, then according to Newtonian physics, life forms represent machines made out of matter. And if you want to understand anything about those machines, then you could take them apart, a process called reductionism, and then upon taking them apart, study the individual pieces of matter, and then see how they work, and then when you put all the pieces back together again, you'd have an understanding of the whole. So now Darwin comes in and says, look, the traits that an individual expresses are connected to their parents. When you apply Newtonian physics, it says that matter is the only thing that we should be focusing on, then all of a sudden it became obvious that something in the sperm and egg that come together during the process of fertilization and result in the formation of a new individual, something physical in those germ cells, the sperm and egg, must be carrying the traits or something that controls the traits in the offspring that will be derived from those germ cells. So the nature of science got immediately myopically focused on saying, what is it? What are those physical things inside a cell that control life? Well, in the early part of this work, it wasn't really clear what those control elements were. Now, Darwin didn't understand the nature of genes, so he actually talked about things called gemmules, which were hypothesized little pieces of matter that controlled the traits, and so that there was like gemmules that make the arm, and gemmules that make legs, and gemmules that make the stomach, etc., that each part of the body had these gemmules, and that in the germ cell, there were going to be a collection of these gemmules that will be passed on to the offspring, and they will control the structure and function of the parts of the offspring. So science started to try to identify what could these gemmules be. And really what this led to was a studies of dividing cells that were first studied around the early 1900s and looking at cells as they divide through microscopes that were getting more sophisticated at the time. They began to see these string-like structures that were present in cells that were beginning to divide. These string-like structures were called chromosomes. They started to recognize that the chromosomes were connected to the heredity. So all of a sudden the focus said, okay, we're beginning to find what controls life. In the germ cells are pieces of matter, and these pieces of matter are called chromosomes and are connected to the transference of traits. Well, the interesting thing about the chromosomes when they started to isolate them and take them apart is that chromosomes were made out of 50% protein and 50% DNA. And they tried to say, okay, which is the part that controls the traits? Is it the protein or the DNA? Because their effort was to take this thing apart and get down to the very nuts and bolts of life, and they were trying to identify which of these components control the traits. Interestingly enough, while the chromosomes were identified around 1900, it was only in 1944 that we actually identified which of those components carried the genetic traits. And it turns out that the experiment by Avery, McLeod, and McCarty in 1944 provided us with the insight through this very simple observation. Avery, McCarty, and McLeod were working with two kinds of bacteria, one type R and one type S. So they're growing the type R bacteria in cultures, and these bacterial cultures, when they grow, make little tiny dot-like colonies, like little BBs all over the petri plate. The other species of bacteria they're working with, type S, the colonies form large, irregular-shaped puddles, so that they had two different traits. The type R had the BB shape. The type S had the big, puddle-shaped colonies that were produced when the cells grew on agar. So the question is, can you change the trait of the colony from one species by using the chromosome material from the other species? Well, the chromosome of type S, they isolated this one, and the type S makes the big puddle-like colony, and they separated the chromosomes into two components, the protein and the DNA. And then they started growing cultures of type R that make the little BB-shaped cultures. And what they did is, in one set of cultures, they added the protein from type S, and another set of cultures, they added the DNA from type S, and then let them grow. What they saw was amazing, was that the type R cultures, little BB-shaped normal cultures, when incubated with DNA from a different species, the type R changed its morphology, changed its shape, and actually started to express the big puddle-like colonies of the type S bacterium. And so what they found was, while the chromosome was made out of protein and DNA, apparently it was the DNA that contained the trait-controlling material, because by adding the DNA from one species to another species, they altered the traits of the recipient species. So all of a sudden the world got very excited, because they said, oh my goodness, after all these years, we finally have gotten down to identifying what is it? What is that genetically controlling material? It appears to be the DNA. So the research didn't take very far from 1944 to 1953. In 1953, the world was stunned by the results of work by James Watson and Francis Crick. Watson and Crick published an article in Nature revealing the structure of the DNA molecule. It showed that this molecule was a double helix, and that each helix was actually a linear chain like beads composed of four different kinds of subunits called the DNA bases. Many of us are familiar with them because the four letters A, T, C, and G are frequently used in describing the nature of the genetic code: adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. And what Watson and Crick revealed was that each strand of the double helix contained a sequence of these bases, and that each of the genes, which are sequences of these bases, had a unique pattern of bases. That the bases actually were blueprints to make the proteins of the body. So the DNA were linear blueprints to make the protein building blocks. So now we must stop for a second and say, well, what are the proteins? Well, the proteins are very large molecules called macromolecules. There are over 100,000 different kinds of macromolecule proteins that are building blocks to make a human body. So that says there are 100,000 different kinds of proteins. Each protein also has a unique structure. But it turns out that the structure of the protein is encoded in the blueprint of the DNA, so that the DNA strands were linear blueprints that would then code for the production of the proteins. So we had over 100,000 different proteins, and the genes were the DNA segments that were the blueprints for each of these proteins.